beginning of the Counter-Reformation. And under that, we began to look at, number one, attitudes of a contemporary pope. We noticed how the pope, when the Reformation began, were worldly rulers who were interested in their own pleasures and the advancement of their families. And the Reformation got well underway before the pope realized its seriousness. Up until 1534, you still have popes of this type, except for the brief time when Adrian VI was pope, from January 1522 to September 1523. In 1534, a new pope was elected, an elderly man named Paul, who took the name of Paul III, who began more energetically to move against Protestantism. He reigned from 1534 to 1549, and his successor reigned 5 years. He was still more wide awake to the situation. And then Paul IV, who had been well known under the name of Carafa, his family name, C-A-R-A-F-F-A, was pope from 1555 to 1559. And during those 5 years, he carried on persecution and the vigorous measures against Protestantism. So he went so far in this that at his death, his property was ransacked by the people of Rome, who rejoiced in being freed from his stern rule. But by this time, a change had been made, a considerable change. And the popes were more intent on proceeding vigorously against Protestantism after this. But I think we can say that the popes, as a great force against Protestantism, were not really very effective. It was others from other directions that the strong, vigorous countermeasures came. The popes, in time, giving their support and blessing to them, but not being primarily responsible or primarily having shown the ability that would make a big difference. Eventually, fully a third of the territory where Protestantism had been active was won back away from it entirely. But very little of the responsibility or credit, whatever you want to call it, for this should properly go to the Pope, except insofar as they gave their support to the measures that others were pushing, except perhaps for one or two of them, even in these cases. It was other forces that were really responsible. Number two, the reformers within the Roman Church. The reformers within the Roman Church. Before the outbreak of the Reformation, for the previous several hundred years, there had been one after another, men who were loyal to the church, but who wrote vigorously about its corruption. And the Council of Constance in 1415 had had as one of its primary purposes, reform of the church. What they meant by reform then was not reformation in the sense of getting back to the gospel and bringing the clear biblical teachings to people, but doing away with the corruption within the church. And these corruptions were obvious for anyone to see. While there were, in every part of Europe, little groups of people who were real Christians, some of them people who were active in different positions in the church, yet a great many of its officials were worldly men simply looking out for their own advantage. And it was perfectly obvious before the Reformation that there was great need of reform within the church. There was all sorts of immorality and wickedness within the church. At this time, a man, that is about 1500, a man who was visiting in Rome, reports that within a few days he saw 100 different corpses floating on the Tiber of people who had been murdered and thrown into the Tiber, and nobody was doing anything about it. So great was the violence and the general wickedness of the area at the time. And people realized that if it was this way at the center of Romanism, certainly something drastic reform was needed. Pope Adrian VI had had a commission which had given reports on the need of reform, and Luther had had this printed and distributed, their statement, because it bore out what he was saying very strongly. During this century, one of the effective things that was done in stopping the progress of Protestantism was to bring about a very considerable measure of reform within the church. One thing, for instance, that was done was the introduction of the confessional booth. Before this time, a woman making confession to a priest knelt at his feet while he sat in a chair. And when a person confessed immorality or wicked thoughts, and they were always brought to try to confess wicked thoughts, if possible, that is still done to this day in the confessional. But when a person would be discussing such intimate things, in that situation, it often led to immorality on the part of the priest. And a reform that was introduced was having the confessional box that you find in Roman Catholic churches today, so that there's no physical contact between the priest and the person who is confessing to him. One of the great types of corruption was what was called absenteeism. A man would be a bishop of a certain area and never go near it. He would draw the income and never go near it. Pluralism went right along with this. In England, there were many men who were important at the king's court who would have as many as 8 or 10 important positions in the church in different parts of England, and also sometimes some positions in countries on the continent. And they would draw the income from all of these and perhaps never go near any of them. During the course of this 16th century, a great part of this deal of this was done away with, and definite rules were made to make such practices very difficult in the future. One practice that was common is what is called nepotism. Nepotism comes from the Latin word nepot, which means a nephew. And it consists of a man putting his nephew into an important position. Nepotism is a word that is used today in any company. If you find that the people in high position get a relative of theirs into a good, well-paying job, the term that's actually used today is nepotism, but it originated in the church from the practice of the Pope and other officers of putting their relatives into important positions. One of the greatest of the persecuting popes, we just mentioned, Paul IV, after his death, the next pope had 4 of his relatives executed, the relatives of previous popes. And as far as evidence goes, the only crime these men were guilty of was that the pope had put them into important positions, as from which they were drawing a good income. But they were beginning to have a revulsion against this thing of nepotism. Paul III, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, had made 2 grandsons of his cardinals. And it was very widespread, and that was a very difficult thing to to do away with. In fact, you'll find it constantly. And of course, you can't simply say that a person should not advance his relatives. They may be people who are thoroughly fitted, well, worthy of a position, and also people in whom he can have more confidence than in strangers. So it's very difficult to draw a clear line on. But these were among the corrupt practices which had developed in the church. And all serious-minded people agreed, something needed to be done about them. And in the course of this century, a good deal was done. But those within the Roman Church who desired to bring reform soon gradually became divided into 2 groups. These groups we'll call small A, those who leaned toward justification by faith. There were many in the church who were anxious to have real progress made in the church, were anxious to have spiritual life improved, Some of them knew a good deal about the Bible, some knew very little about it. But many of these were greatly affected by the stress on justification by faith. You remember we mentioned Virgilio, the papal representative who had visited Luther in Wittenberg. How shortly after he went back, he was made bishop of a large area in northern Italy, and after a time, word came to Rome that he was preaching justification by faith in all of the parts of his area there. And when Virgilio was given orders to report to Rome, instead of going to Rome, he fled north into Switzerland and went to Geneva. He did that because by that time some others had been accused of preaching justification by faith and had been executed for it. But there were prominent cardinals in the church in the first few years after the beginning of the Reformation who felt that this was a true biblical teaching and who were leaning strongly in that direction. As late as 1540, a man in Rome made this statement in the book he wrote. He said, "No one now passes at Rome as a cultivated man or a good courtier who does not harbor some heretical opinion." And Luther said on 1538 that he had heard from Rome that it was their belief it was impossible to refute him unless St. Paul should be deposed. And so there was quite a movement within the church of individuals who wanted to take what they found that was true in Luther's band, but who wanted to avoid the division in the church and wanted to move the church in that direction. There were very large numbers who felt that way. On the other hand, there were many in the church who strongly defended the medieval superstition. So this would be the defenders of the medieval superstition and accretion. There were many who felt in this situation now we have Luther and Calvin and these others leading groups away from the supremacy of the Pope. The thing for us to do is to take a firm, strong stand on the views the church now holds and to make no compromise with them. And this was a view that eventually won out within the church. It won out as some of the others, those who held the other view, of course, died before this reached their climax. Others of them, like Virgilio, had to flee for their lives. Many were persecutors burned at the stake for their view. A very interesting case is the case of Professor Bartolomeo Carranza, C-A-R-R-A-N-Z-A, Bartolome Carranza. Carranza lived from 1503 to 1576. He was a man of noble family in Spain who had joined the Dominican order, became a very prominent professor in that order. Students from all parts of Spain flocked to hear him. In 1530, he was denounced to the Inquisition as leaning toward the opinions of Erasmus. But the charges against him did not stand up, and he went on to become more famous. He was professor of philosophy there in Spain. He visited Rome, where he was made doctor of theology. He represented the emperor at the Council of Trent. He had close contact with many of the popes. Charles V, the emperor, sent him to England with his son Philip. When Philip married the Queen of England, he became Mary's confessor. He labored earnestly in England for the re-establishment of Romanism during this period when most of the Protestant leaders were in exile or else were burned by Mary. He returned then to Spain and was made Archbishop of Toledo. And he was at the deathbed of the Emperor Charles VI. We've already described earlier how after he gave extreme unction to the emperor on his deathbed, he held up the crucifix before him. And he said, "Do you put your trust for salvation in the one who is pictured here on this crucifix as having borne your sins on the cross?" And before the dying emperor could say anything, one who represented the other viewpoint as to the sort of reform that was needed, stepped up and brusquely pushed him aside and said to the emperor, "Sire, do you put your confidence in the church and what it stands for and what it believes?" And soon after that, he was arrested by the Inquisition. He was Archbishop of Toledo. He was had been one of the leaders in the Roman Church before, one of the leaders in opposing Protestantism. But they declared that one of his books against Lutheranism actually taught justification by faith. And he was accused of this. He was put into prison and was in prison there for nearly 8 years. And it was ordered that his books should be destroyed, no one permitted to read them. After 8 years, he got opportunity to appeal to Rome. He was taken there in 1566, and there he was 10 more years in prison. So he was 18 years in prison on account of his being suspected of believing in justification by faith. A man who had such great high positions within the church and such respect of various popes and of the emperor himself. After these 18 years, finally the judgment was given that they found no proof of heresy. After 18 years he'd been in prison. But they said that he had made certain statements that were erroneous, grabbing sentences out of context from his writings. They said that there were 16 errors in his writings which he must publicly declare that he does not hold. They suspended him from his position for 5 years. He was to stay in a cloister, in a Dominican cloister in Rome for these 5 years before he could reassume his position in Spain. 7 days, however, after his public recantation of these errors, he died. Yet the Spanish people honored him as a saint, and a later pope placed a laudatory inscription on his tomb in Rome. But the experience of this man shows how you had these two forces within the church which were struggling, and the one which stood for the medieval superstition was gaining the upper hand. Now, number three is establishment of the Roman Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition had been in existence for a long time. The Spanish Inquisition had been used against Moors and Jews in Spain. And it was right at hand and vigorous, and it was not difficult for it to deal with the rise of Protestantism in Spain. The Spanish Inquisition had already burned thousands of people. Up to 1540, they had burned over 20,000 people at the stake, the Spanish Inquisition. But very few of these were Protestants. They were mostly ex-Jews or ex-Moors. When, however, Protestantism began to get a hold in Spain, it was quite easy for the Inquisition, which was already in full force there, to wipe it up. In 1559, 24 men were burnt in Seville, being accused of following Luther's teaching, 32 in 1562, and 19 accused of following Calvin's teaching in 1569. There's a book published by the Moody Press called The Spanish Brothers. It's a little story, it's a full-length story, but it very beautifully portrays the situation in Spain at that time. It shows two brothers who came to hear about Protestantism, or about the Bible, rather, and came to love the Bible and attend meetings there in Spain, show their contact with others, their influence, and how the Inquisition finally came in. And one of them was burned at the stake, and the other one escaped to England in the story. But it's very beautifully told and gives a very excellent picture of the situation as it was, and shows the different types of people those who were, had positions in the church that they wanted to hold, and they wanted to destroy anything that threatened them, and on the other hand chose the real fanatics who were sincerely anxious to maintain what they thought was right. It's a very beautiful picture of the events, which I don't know whether the specific events described there actually happened, but certainly they may have happened. The general situation, the general background is, I believe, very accurate in this story. Protestantism was unable to get much of a start in Spain, as you see, because the Inquisition was already active there and vigorous. But this Spanish Inquisition had been confined to Spain and to a slight extent to the Spanish possessions in the New World. But in 1542, Paul III instituted an Inquisition in Rome, which was called then the Roman Inquisition. And this Inquisition set to work to put an end to Protestantism in Italy, and it proceeded vigorously from then on. And bishops and leaders in the church were condemned by it. Michelangelo, the great, one of the greatest artists in history, certainly, was a close friend of a woman named Vittoria Colonna, who was certainly very close to Protestant views, whether she actually held them or not. She was of such a high, noble family, they found in her case they could simply order her to get back to her family estate and stay there with practically no contact with anyone else. But there was in Naples, there was a Spaniard named Valdes, V-A-L-D-E-S, who had left Spain on account of the Inquisition and come to Naples, which was under Spanish control, but in which the Spanish Inquisition was not active. Valdes made translations of many parts of the Bible from the Greek and the Hebrew into Spanish, and he wrote about 15 books presenting Christian truth, which were written in Spanish and translated into Italian and widely read in Italy. He also published a book by a friend of his called On the Benefits of Christ's Death, which was a very clear picture of salvation by faith, and of which 40,000 copies circulated in Italy. And the Inquisition set to work to destroy all the copies of these books, and was so effective that a few years ago it was thought that this book On the Benefits of Christ's Death, that there wasn't a single copy left. And then there was found a copy in the British Museum, which definitely had been brought there by some traveler who brought books from Italy, and the British Museum simply took them in, and they had not realized what all they had there. And they found this book there a few years ago, and of course it's now quite prized because it's the only one left of a book that had such wide circulation for a time. So in the areas where there were Romanists in the position of high leadership and power, Protestantism was pretty well wiped out by the measures of the Inquisition. But this would not have pushed it back in the areas in which it already had a good start. It took other measures to do that. Before we look at them, we mention number four, the index. Number four is the index. No sooner had printing been invented than leaders in the church had realized that great results would follow from people widely reading literature that would be injurious to the church. And so as early as 1485, the Archbishop of Mainz had published a decree saying that whereas the divine art of printing had been abused for the sake of lucre, and whereas by this means even Christ's books, missals, and other works on religion were thumbed by the vulgar, and whereas the German language was too poor to express such mysteries, and common persons too ignorant to understand them, therefore every work translated into German must be approved by the doctors of the University of Mainz before being published. This was as early as 1485. But you remember that printing was just beginning to be widespread when the Reformation began. And not only did printing give a great impetus to the reading of Luther's work, but Luther's writings gave a great impetus to printing, because people were so anxious to read them that it tremendously increased the number of printed books that were being distributed. And so the church set to work to make laws regarding censorship and ordering that certain books should not be published or should not be read by Romanists at all. And the index was the name given to the list of books. The University of Louvain in Belgium made up a big list of works that were not to be read. And this list has been kept up through the succeeding century, dividing works into three classes. Authors who had erred intentionally and whose works were therefore forbidden, authors who erred occasionally and some of whose books were forbidden, and then all anonymous books were forbidden. And almost any book by a Roman Catholic press today, you will find in the front a little statement which says, nihil obstat, and then signed by a man who is called a censor, who is a man who reads the book and says that it is a permissible book. And then it says imprimatur, Latin word, let it be printed. And this is signed by a bishop or an archbishop of the room, who has not necessarily himself read the book, but who gives the permission that it be printed on the authority of the, or following the judgment of the censor, whose name is also included in the summary. I picked up a book in the recently, a Bible dictionary, which a one-volume Bible dictionary written by a Roman Catholic just within the last 10 years, a very learned Roman Catholic. In the front of it, he mentions how grateful he is to McCormick Seminary in Chicago for allowing him the full use of their library, where he spent many months studying books on the Bible in preparing this Bible dictionary. But it was interesting to read in the front of this, which has an imprimatur on it, of course, to read his statement. He was a Jesuit, and he says that before his book was published, it was read by 8 learned Jesuits, carefully read by them, and they made many changes in the book. And he says he knows the changes greatly improved the book, and he would like to express personally his gratitude to them, because he can't do it personally because he's never been told who the men are. But he wants in this way, in this general way in his writing, to express how grateful he is for the way that these men, unknown to him, improved his book. And so you see the effort that was made to keep from the hands of people books that they felt might be injurious. Many editions and versions of the Bible were listed as forbidden. Erasmus was, they went through Erasmus' work carefully, and they include over 100 pages of lists of passages in Erasmus' work, which are not to be printed or to be read by faithful Romans. So this effort of the index was one effort to try to stop the progress of Protestant thought. This method, however, has not been so successful. I recently saw a book, a set of books, 7-volume Life of Luther, written by a very learned Romanist. And in these 7 volumes, it's most interesting how he takes up every criticism of Luther and tries to find all the evidence about it, very, very carefully. The man is evidently a very careful scholar, because in most cases he proves that the charges against Luther are false. I think there's a set of these books in the University of Pennsylvania Library, this set, and it was presented to them by the Knights of Columbus. It's interesting how it actually answers most charges against Luther. I believe the man must have been criticized for the generally objective tone of his 7 volume, because a one-volume life of Luther was recently issued under his name, which just picks out the critical statements about Luther from the seven volumes and prints them together. And that gives a very different impression of Luther than if you read the whole seven volumes. But it was interesting to read how, in one case where he took up one of the criticisms of Luther and showed how it was absolutely without foundation, he said, "Isn't it strange," he said, "that so many Catholic books say this about Luther when there's absolutely no foundation to it?" Well, he said the explanation for it is in the fact that the Romanists were forbidden to read Luther's work or to read Protestant books about him. Even Jesuits were forbidden to read them, he said. And consequently, he said, the men who wrote this book attacking Luther simply had to copy from previous attacks on him because they were not allowed to go to source material. He mentions that situation as having been in existence comparatively recently. But the index was a means which was very vigorously used in order to try to stop Protestantism. It's interesting that they not only went through religious books, but other books like Boccaccio's Decameron. And Preserved Smith says, it is noteworthy that the Decameron was expurgated, not chiefly for its indecency, but for its satire of Ecclesiastics. Thus, a tale of the seduction of an abbess is rendered acceptable by changing the abbess into a countess. The story of how a priest led a woman astray by impersonating the angel Gabriel is merely changed by making the priest a layman masquerading as a fairy king. And thus, the attempt was made by the index to stop anything that would represent ecclesiastical leaders in a bad light. Now, the index was a great hindrance to progress of thought, and it's probably one of the reasons for the great change that took place. In 1500, Italy and Spain, southern Europe, was by far the most progressive part of Europe. In industry, in wealth, in learning, in most ways, it was way ahead of the northern countries. Yes? They were prepared by officials for the purpose, and there's still a committee in Rome that has this function, but the members have changed the time. I mentioned the University of Louvain, as L-O-U-V-A-I-N, as having made the first extensive list. That was they merely made the first extensive list. After that, it was taken over by others. But their list was greatly used. They having devoted more attention to it than any other up to that time. The index then was a method which held back individual thought to a great extent. And it was the repressive measure of the Counter-Reformation which caused Italy and Spain to fall far back in the next few years, while Northern Europe, where there was more freedom of thought and where there was the effect on character produced by the teachings of the Reformation, went way ahead of what they had been before and way ahead of Italy and of Spain. Now, this is these measures that we have looked at thus far were largely repressive measures. Now, we want to mention number five, the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent. You remember that when Luther first began to criticize the matter of indulgences, and when he found that the Pope was standing, that the men in the papal court were simply standing on what the situation was and refusing to examine it in the light of Scripture or to discuss it further, that Luther appealed to a general council to be held. And the Pope declared that he would excommunicate anyone who would appeal to a general council to be held. Back in 1415, the Council of Constance had deposed three popes and had elected a new one, and had made a rule that every 10 years Thereafter, there must be a general council. And it was the idea of the Council of Constance that the Pope should be simply a sort of executive officer. But the Pope were able to get around that, and after calling two councils and managing to get rid of them before they did much, they just stopped calling councils. And for very few councils had been called since that time. The Pope, as a rule, have not liked the idea of councils. And they have put their stress on their own power and authority in the main. But Charles the Emperor, you remember, always said, we must have a church council. We must have a general council. He'd like to get representatives of all Christians together, have them decide these matters, decide how much of what Luther said was right, how much was wrong, what the situation was, and then he would enforce throughout the church whatever the council decided. But for 20 years, he was trying to get the Pope to call a council, and the Pope kept putting him off on one excuse and another. Finally, in response to Charles' effort, the Pope did call a council. Charles wanted a council held in Germany. And that was where the greater part of the discussion was. He wanted the council to be in Germany. So the Pope called a council in a German city. But a German city about 5 miles from the border of Italy. And north of this German city, there was all the Alps in between it and Germany. It was, today, the city actually is a part of Italy, the city of Trent. But at that time, it was a German city, but just on the very edge of Italy, easily reached from any part of Italy because it was in the just the beginning of the hill and north of Italy, but you had the whole stretch of the Alps to cross over to get to it from any part of what is today Germany. And so he called this council to meet in Trent, and they invited the Protestants to come to it. But by this time, the Protestants realized how different their view was from the view that the Pope were insisting upon, realized that there was no point in trying to get together or to agree to be subject to the decision of a council which would be under control of those who were not giving the scripture the place of supremacy in determining what was true. Well, now this Council of Trent was called in 1545. And you realize, of course, that that is just 1 year before Luther's death. And you realize that it's just 2 years before Charles succeeded in conquering all of Germany. So that it was in a very troubled time when the council met. There were only 34 members at this meeting of the council who were entitled to vote. 4 cardinals, 4 archbishops, 21 bishops, and 5 generals of order. And this meeting of the council in Trent was held so completely under the Pope's power that the French ambassador bitterly said that the Holy Ghost came to Trent every day in the mailbag from Rome. And the French were quite disgusted at how completely the Pope was managing to hold it under his control. Well, now the Council of Trent met for these 2 years, and then it was recessed, and it continued again from 1551 to 52. And had a third session from 1562 to 3. Thus, you see, its meetings were stretched over a period of 18 years. And in the council, there was a sharp struggle between all those who, practically all who were in the council, were definitely loyal to the church. There was one time when a group of Protestants where they came to the council, presented a statement, and left. But aside from that, Protestants had no part in the council. But those who were in the council were all loyal to the church, but were greatly divided as to what the policy should be. There were those who said, these Protestants have found certain truths which we've been neglecting. And we should take a stand on the truth as it's found in the Bible. There were others who said, we must stand for what the church stands for today and avoid any deviation from it. And the feeling was very keen in the council. In fact, it was so keen that the representatives, the members sometimes got into fistfights. Smith says, the passions of the Right Reverend Fathers were so excited by the consideration of a fundamental article of their faith that in the course of disputation they accused one another of conduct unbecoming to Christians, taunted one another with plebeian origin, and tore hair from one another's beards. And the feeling was very intense in the council at various times. But by the various ways in which the Pope held control over the council, and more particularly in the latter sessions of the council, by the activities of the Jesuit order in it, they succeeded in getting the council to take action which firmly stood upon the medieval superstition and refused to make any compromise whatever with the views of the Reformers. And when the council was over, many of the people felt it had been an utter failure. It had not conciliated people. It had not brought them together. It simply had taken a firm, unbending stand against everything that Luther and Calvin had been advancing. But what it did was to crystallize the view, which had been a view held by many within the church before, but many holding views very close to those of Calvin and Luther had been well accepted within the church for centuries before. Now this made a crystallized, hostile view to the position of Calvin and Luther. They definitely denied justification by faith, but did it in rather vague language. They definitely said that it was both faith and works together that justify, and this irritated many who wanted to move much further than that in the direction of justification by faith. They said the Bible alone is not the authority. Tradition also is an authority. They said that when there were at least half of the council originally wanted to stick to the books of the Hebrew Bible as the Old Testament. But it's pretty hard to argue that there's a purgatory when you find nothing about it anywhere in the Old and New Testament. And when they had had arguments about purgatory, on the Bible, when the Protestants would say there's nothing in the Bible about purgatory, the answer would be, oh yes, there is. There is in the Bible. Where is that? Why, in 1 Maccabees. Well, you look at 1 Maccabees and you find a statement there that certain men who had died in battle were found to have heathen charms on them. And therefore, that they prayed for these people that they would escape from eternal fire. And of course, what was meant was that we pray that these people may have not meant anything, they're having these heathen charms. But these are not indications that they truly were following these heathen deities, in which case they certainly be lost. That was, of course, what was meant by the statement in 1 Maccabees. But it's about the only thing in the scripture to take as an evidence for praying for the dead or for purgatory is this statement that in the days of the Maccabees that they did pray for these particular people who had died in battle. And of course the easier answer, instead of arguing on the basis of what's said there, the easier answer is to say why 1 Maccabees isn't part of the Bible. And actually the head of the Church of Spain at the time of the beginning of Reformation, Cardinal Ximenes, published a book, the Complutensian Polyglot, an edition of the Bible in several volumes, in which he said in the introduction that the whole church is grateful to St. Jerome for clearly distinguishing the books of the Old Testament from the other books that are not part of the Old Testament, such as 1 Maccabees. And so at the Council of Trent, there were many who said we should stand on the Hebrew Old Testament as the Bible. But there were others who said, no, we must stand on every book that is in the Vulgate, in the Latin translation of the Bible, which is the standard Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. although it was a translation made by St. Jerome, who refused to translate these extra books. He did translate two of them eventually in response to much urging, but he did those two very hurriedly and refused altogether to translate the other five. But somebody else translated them. It was in the copies of the Vulgate. It is to this day. And so the Council of Trent, after much argument, the Jesuits succeeded in getting them to take the action that the Bible must be taken, including all the books that are in the so-called Apocrypha. We Protestants call them Apocrypha. They simply call them part of the Old Testament. But many prominent leaders before that time had denied that they belong in the Bible. And so the Council of Trent made a definite, forthright position. And this position was to be enforced where the Romanists had power. Now, all these measures together, I do not think, would have resisted the progress of Protestantism if it weren't for one other thing. By this time, Austria was almost entirely Protestant. A representative of the Pope said that the emperor and this envoy from the Pope, he thought, were the only Roman Catholics left in Vienna. Well, today, practically everybody in Vienna is at least nominally Roman Catholic. The Counter-Reformation completely won us back. But I do not think that it would have been done by any of the measures we just looked at or all of them put together. The real thing that caused that the Roman Church would survive, but not only would survive, but would win back great areas from Protestantism, was something which the leaders had no idea of the importance of when it started, but which actually was the great force in preserving it and in enabling it to win back great areas. And so, well, that will be capital D then. Capital D, the foundation of the Company of Jesus. The foundation of the Company of Jesus. Now, this word company was a military word. Military. And so by the Company of Jesus, they meant like an army. The word society was used in the same sense. The Society of Jesus is the way it's generally translated to English. And when you see a man's name with the letter S.J. after it, it refers to this organization. Now, there were many orders in the Roman Church before this time, and there were many new ones started at this time. But this order, which was started after the beginning of the Reformation, came to be the most prominent and the strongest order, though far from the largest, in the Roman Church. It's the strongest, it's the most powerful by far today. But it is not the largest. It has always been very selective as to its membership. And we look at its history now. The foundation of the Company of Jesus, that's capital D. Number one, Ignatius Loyola's early life. Ignatius, I-G-N-A-T-I-U-S, Loyola, you probably all are familiar with that name. There are many colleges in America, I believe, called Loyola College. L-O-Y-O-L-A. Ignatius Loyola's early life. Now, Ignatius Loyola was a Spaniard, a young Spanish soldier. And he was a very energetic man, a man who was a great reader of romances at the time, and a lover of war, and one who was determined to become a great hero, a famous soldier. He was very active in war, and in 1521, he was defending a fortress against desperate odds from a French attack, and he was wounded in the leg with a cannonball. The leg then, later, was badly set, and the bone knit crooked. With great courage, he had it broken again. There's no There were no anesthetics, as you know, at the time. He had the leg broken again and reset, and had himself stretched to pull it apart to try to keep it straight, had the protruding bone sawed off. He did anything he could to try to get himself back in condition to be a great soldier. But when he was about 28, he found that he was a cripple for life. And he could not become a great soldier. And then in the long hours of slow healing, he read he tried to get romances of chivalry, but he was unable to get a hold of them, and the best thing he could get a hold of was Legends of the Saints and the story of the life of Christ. And as he read them, he said, why not become a great saint like Dominic or Francis, perhaps even surpass them? So he took the Madonna for his lady and determined to become a soldier of Christ. And as soon as he was able to move, he made a pilgrimage and dedicated his arms in the church in imitation of the knights he'd read about. And then there began a period when he was trying to decide just how he could proceed to become a great saint and a great leader. And he had tremendous willpower, and he made a vow to preach to the infidels, and he made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, but he was turned back by the Franciscan leader there. Then coming back to Spain in 1524, he began to learn Latin, which he hadn't known before, and he went in with a boy in the school learning Latin. And then he went to the university, and he was there suspected and imprisoned for 6 weeks by the Inquisition. Two or three times, different times, he was seized by the Inquisition and examined and prohibited from holding religious meetings, and he had to leave Spain because of the danger to him. Of course, they couldn't find anything heretical in his teaching at all. He wanted to become a great saint, a great leader, but he was working out his own way, and they were very suspicious of him. But we'll continue and look at Loyola next time.